U.S. economy lost 33,000 jobs, negative 33,000 jobs since in September.
How much can we blame on the hurricane?
I think a lot. I think ultimately this is hurricane weakness. 1.5 million people did not go to work due to the weather.
Oil prices are holding steady today. Traders are eyeing Tropical Storm Nate, which is shutting down some production in the Gulf of Mexico ahead of its expected U.S. landfall this weekend.
But I do regard it as a bubble. I think we've been in bubble and bust land since the late 1990s.
We very much believe that our tax cuts will stimulate real economic growth in the United States and will pay for themselves. Yes, we believe that.
We're really poised for great things. Our nation's like a coiled spring. The American manufacturing renaissance is really going to happen. And this president's plan for tax reform is going to do wonders for getting this economy really rocking.
I mean, there's nothing more fun than a bull market and a good growth economy where Americans like each other rather than hate each other. I mean, it gets rid of all of these peripheral and side problems. It's just, it's really fun being in a bull economy.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Another positive week for the stock market. It just seems like a broken record. Every single week we report to you, the stock market has hit another record. We have some good economic reports coming out. The dollar is in a countercyclical rally, which is weakening some of the commodities. We'll be here to talk about that. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in the first hour, Bruce Kamich from Money.com will be joining us. He's one of the few technicians that sees some trouble on the horizon further out for the stock market. You're going to want to hear what he's watching and what he sees and why he is somewhat cautionary. Also joining us from Raymond James, their chief energy director, Marshall Atkins will be joining us talking about the negative feedback loop and how a lot of these numbers that we're seeing coming out in energy, you've heard the term before, could be just fake news. If you look at the fundamentals underneath the market and the physical market, it is speaking a different picture from what you're hearing from the media. You're going to want to hear what he has to say and why he thinks $60 oil is a bigger reality than most people think, and even $65 next year. He'll be joining me in hour one, along with Ryan Poplava, on what moved the markets this week. All of that in the first hour.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, it seems like the financial crisis is a distant memory now. Wait, it's 8 years behind. And after huddling in fear on the sideline, the small investor is getting into the market. But wait, we're entering the third stage of the bull market. And also we're in a rate raising cycle. And since financial market people are always looking into the future to try to tell us what's happening, what does that really mean? Are we headed down to another recession? And is there danger ahead? What is the risk factor? All of that. Subject of conversation coming up today on The Big Picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And welcome back, Ryan Poplava, CEO of Poplava Financial Services, to another wrap-up report on the financial markets this week. What can you tell us were the main drivers and catalysts affecting the market this week?
There weren't any, I'd say, wow moments like we had last week with the release of that Trump and Ryan tax reform plan. That was a pretty big deal. And still, we're going to be working that out as it progresses through in the normal congressional process. But this week, there were plenty of items that definitely essentially didn't detract from that rally that started last week. One of the more important macro items this week, John, I'd say, was just that the House passed a $4.1 trillion budget that slashes spending over the next 10 years. So, okay, cutting fiscal spending, that's typically a stimulus. So by cutting it, was that necessarily a great thing? On the onset, no. But what it does is it kind of paves the way for the Republicans to continue to move forward on tax reform, because a lot of Congress wants to see a balanced budget. They want to see something that doesn't net really hurt and detract from that deficit that we currently have. And so to get there, this was a great step in that direction. But again, it was just the House. So the Senate still has to pass something of their own. The Republicans don't have as strong of a foothold there. So some concessions will have to be given most likely. But still, like I said, it's a good step. And, you know, the S&P 500 equity index, it tracked another historic record close throughout this week. In fact, it had six consecutive historic record closes. And essentially, we haven't seen that since like 1997. And then despite the drop at the end on Friday on the jobs report, we did finish the week up 1.19%. So it was a great week. But I would say the other important items this week were mainly the economic numbers, which were, for the most part, extremely positive, except for the jobs report, but we'll go into that. Based on the results, essentially, questions were answered for how much the hurricanes really affected September's numbers, August numbers, and we've come away with data that's very supportive of economic progress, very supportive towards a December hike also because of the progress we've had in pricing, in wage inflation, and wage growth. There was some, and that's why we saw some progress on Friday that despite the drop, there was a drop of 33,000 jobs were taken away, no additions in that sense, a net, you know, we had 33,000 loss in jobs for September. But like I said, the one plus in there was that wage growth was up. End result, Thursday, the probability of a rate hike in December was like, I think, in the 70% range. Probability went up to 90%. Again, even though the jobs report was a drop, it went up because of the hourly earnings went up almost 0.5%.
Well, you know, Ryan, usually in the first week of the month, we do get a lot of important market-moving data like the jobs report and the ISM figures for manufacturing and non-manufacturing development. So what were some of the other major economic announcements this week?
Those two were key. The data has been essentially positive for the most part this week. Both of those ISM figures were positive with gains in manufacturing in September. And it's actually been at the highest level since May of 2004, just to give you some idea of how things have been progressing there in manufacturing. But it was also accompanied by the highest price index component since May of 2011. So again, going into those two things, okay, yes, we've got some progress on the economic headline numbers, but we're also looking really deeply into the price components of everything economically that's coming across our desk. Services basically mirrored that same report with a headline number that was higher on Wednesday and then a price component that also jumped. Construction spending went up. The trade balance narrowed. Construction spending was up. Factory orders for August were up 1.2%. And then August inventories were also up. All of these are very constructive towards the development of our third quarter GDP figures. And so just to see what was going on there, because the jobs report, negative, did affect estimates. So I always go to the Atlanta Fed's site, looking at their GDP Now forecast at the end of the week, just to get an idea, a rough idea. Okay, you get all this data coming in. What's the net effect? These guys do a great job modeling that. And overall, we've seen the GDP estimates go up in the last few weeks from, I think it bottomed at 2% for the third quarter. We're now at 2.5%. The highest so far this week was on Thursday at 2.8%. So that jobs report did bring it down a little bit. Overall, net increase from last week's estimates. So we continue to see third quarter estimates have been going up based on the models we're looking at for GDP from the Atlanta Fed.
How do you guys see things playing out for the rest of the year? You think the strength is going to continue?
Well, John, most economists, when they model expectations, they do the very same thing we technical analysts do. They project the existing trend forward until it changes and inflects. If results are trending higher or lower, the next data point essentially is just going to get adjusted respectively. So looking at one of the economic indicators we follow, which is another attempt to kind of summarize everything that's going on, is the City Economic Surprise Index. You'll hear Chris talk about it to our clients in the next strategy meeting, and Jim talks about it all the time. The index measures data as it surprises relative to market expectations, because that's, you know, the market is, there's that rule that it prices everything in. Of course, it can't perfectly do that, but the theory is that it is the summation of all information that's relative and out there right now. So if results, when they come in, they surprise, that's going to move the market down or up. This indicator went negative from May until just recently going positive, and that bottomed in June and has been in the steady rise, showing us that net results are coming in above expectations now. And that's a great sign, and a lot of our researchers that we follow have had this opinion that the second half we would see this happen, and it's just now happening. And so, yes, it's definitely, we think this strength will continue throughout the rest of this year.
Well, you know, Ryan, you and Jim have been highlighting the resurgence of energy. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago here on the program. And to a lesser degree, financials based on some of the catalysts that you were looking at last month. So how are things doing for those two things?
Well, oil bounced around quite a bit this week, a slight drop, and I'm not too surprised. It had a really nice move over the last month off of some great catalysts. You know, the OPEC, the Iraqi minister basically talking about OPEC wanting to cut production and extend it next year when they really take a look at it in the first quarter. But it essentially closed below 50 on a couple of things that affected how traders were viewing oil this week. And one of them was a report really at the start of the week that suggested OPEC members were cheating on their production. Basically, we looked at production in September. There was a rise of 50,000 barrels, and essentially looking at the results, that's suggesting like an 86% compliance of that supply cut deal. So, and a whole bunch of ministers came out later through the week talking about, no, we're much higher. But that was the news article that hit traders and affected oil at the start of the weekend. And to end it, you know, we've got this tropical storm coming in, Nate, expected to be hurricane strength in the Gulf. And there's fears that that could possibly shut down refineries. You shut down refineries, you shut down demand for crude oil, hence the drop in crude oil prices on Friday. So even though prices and energy are up, and overall over the past month and a half, you know, energy stocks have performed well in September also, the West Texas Intermediate oil is still trading, this is the technical analyst in me, in a very defined trading zone between 45 and 60. And at 50, John, you know, the risk isn't bad, but the upside is also limited. You know, it's had a really hard time getting above 60. And then again, here we go. The U.S. rig count went up recently, and it wouldn't be hard for more to come online should prices go up. We still have a lot of rigs that have been sidelined since the peak a couple years ago. So I see better long-term potential for financials, and I've been very strong on financials with my clients and myself, and we are in general. We've got a good position there, overweight the S&P. Looking at just the rise in rates and reflationary expectations, and of course, economic conditions. If you think economic conditions are going to do well, then so should the company's financing growth. So just this week, another item that was key for the financials, the Senate confirmed Randall Quarles as a member of the Federal Reserve Board. That's a positive for financials because he's mentioned before that he'd like to reduce bank regulations. And we've also heard that from Trump earlier in this year. So, you know, both of those are kind of going in that right direction. So again, rising rates, good for financials, economic strength, good for financials, and then deregulation, maybe coming down the pike. We haven't seen that priced in. We haven't seen a whole lot of information on that, but here we go. And here's another important figure who is wanting to aim in that direction.
And Ryan, any other important stories that you've come across this week or you'd like listeners to be aware of?
I think that really covers everything on the macro level. You know, there were plenty of individual stock news events through earnings and other such items that maybe helped them personally, but didn't really move any specific industry groups like some of those NVIDIA upgrades did for all the semiconductors in September. I thought the hearing into Wells Fargo's fake accounts and the Equifax data breach, I know some of my clients have called in very concerned about that, wondering what we're doing about it. I found that hearing very interesting. In fact, they're finding that Equifax, they're getting all these people signing up for monitoring because they're offering it for free. Net result, you know, after that comp period is over, they're going to start making a lot more money based on this data breach. So, you know, who knows? There might be some regulation coming in for them. There might be some, you know, fines. I don't think the government would look very highly on a company that has such a big issue like that, that hurts the consumer and then makes money off of it. That could be like a tobacco situation where they get fined. But nothing else really moving the market, just some interesting stuff here and there, per usual.
Yeah, that sounds like one of those whatever endings.
Yeah, that's the market. Yeah, that's the great and fun part of it. And, I read an article there's that book out, Principles, from Ray Dalio. I read an article in the Institutional Magazine, just essentially it was an interview with Ray Dalio, talking about what he does and what he's done to come out of that a little abyss period he went through in 1982, where he had to borrow money from his dad. Essentially, he talks about everything that he uses to set up to be successful now. And one of the key things he talks about is his group looks at the market and has a research report every Friday, 600 pages. They read through it over the weekend, then discuss it on Monday. And that's the key. You know, you look at everything that's out there. He said, what is happening in the world today? And then you discuss it and you figure out where are the catalysts. And I tell you, John, doing this job, talking to our listeners for the last few years about this, it has incredibly helped me personally. I got to give a hand of applause for all of our listeners who religiously follow us and listen to me talk about this, sometimes some nonsense that happens every week. But some of the, you know, hopefully there's some gems in there for our listeners.
Ryan, appreciate it. Hopefully we'll see you back again next week. Ryan Poplava.
We'll do. We'll see you then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
One of the things that I came across in writing about data centers is the role of the data center in high-frequency trading. So you talked about the role of the algorithm in HFT and the ability of the machine to execute these trades. But the other component of how high-frequency trading firms make money is not just this, the algorithms to execute the trade, but the infrastructure needed to transmit that information about the trade. And that's where the data center comes in. In addition to the data centers, the fiber optic cables and increasingly things like microwave towers are the conduits of how HFT trade information are actually transmitted. And so fiber optic cables are a great example, like the telegraph, like the railroad before it, of this idea of time-space compression. Michael Lewis in Flash Boys has this great story about how a firm called Spread Networks kind of initiated what's been referred to now as an arms race within the HFT world to find the shortest route between trading platforms. And Spread Networks built a fiber optic cable between Chicago and New York that was, I think, 3 or 4 milliseconds faster than the existing networks. And they achieved that shorter distance by essentially hugging a geodesic line.
Well, the stock markets are going up record after record, almost like a broken record we report every single week. We tell you the stock market is at a new record. But not everybody agrees. Joining us on the program from Money.com is Bruce Kamish. And Bruce, let's talk about some of the things that you're seeing that cause you alarm in terms of where this market is heading.
Well, early June, I did a piece for Real Money. I work for Jim Cramer during the daytime and teach at Baruch College at night. And I've learned over the many years of being in the business, you don't want to use the B word. You don't want to describe yourself as a bear. It paints you in a corner. Wall Street doesn't like it. And you always have to perpetually prove yourself. I mean, you can be a bull and be wrong on Wall Street and they forgive you. You know, if you decide to be a bear and you're not right or you're early, whatever the case is, you always have to prove yourself. So try to stay away from the B word. But what I didn't like back in May and June, and it's somewhat continued, is that it's a mature bull market in terms of time cycles. You have a 4, 4.5 year cycle, you know, about 53 months on average. And we're long in the tooth of that second cycle off the March 2009 low. The breadth of the market has kept up, depending on how you measure it. You know, you can use all securities, you can use just stocks, and you can be a subscriber to Lowry's and just use their operating company only numbers. But the numbers, the breadth numbers have gone up, and people that look at breadth, you know, say it's wonderful. But the momentum on breadth, you can run a momentum study and look at the rate of change in breadth, has been slowing for months. So yes, breadth is pointed up, it's still going up, but it's been slowing. Another thing I haven't liked for a while is the last hour indicator. This was something that Stan Weinstein came up with in the mid-70s. I took it and used it on bond futures at one time, looking at the last half hour of trading. Futures just have a much shorter lifespan than equities. And, you know, the market could be up 150 points at 3 o'clock and, you know, it finishes up 85, you know, and the talking heads on that TV show, you know, say it's up 8 out of the last 9. You know, they missed the backstory beneath the surface, you know, that somebody's selling into it, you know, from 3 to 4 o'clock. They want to be less bullish or maybe a little more short. That's bothered me for a while. The narrowness of the advance bothers me. We can probably find 15, 20 stocks that, you know, are the majority of the advance on the NASDAQ. You know, we know all those names, the NVIDIAs and the Broadcoms and so forth. And so if you're trying to match the performance or beat that performance, you have to be in those names. So it becomes a narrow door and, you know, kind of reminds some people that have been around the block a few times, you know, like the Nifty 50, which didn't end well.
Bruce, how much of that has to do with something I have been following, which is indexing, which passive investing has taken over? It's become very popular. And if you are, let's say, Vanguard, Fidelity, or BlackRock, you're running an ETF or a mutual fund that's an index fund. If you have a NASDAQ index fund, you get $100 million, 13% of it is going into Amazon. There's no thinking behind any of this. It just goes in. How much of this passive indexing is reinforcing this thing that you're seeing where the narrowness of the advance, there's fewer and fewer companies that are driving these averages higher?
Yeah, and it's building on itself. And I think that also explains the low numbers for the VIX. And, you know, there's very little transactional business being done at sell-side firms. They moved their business model away from that. You know, they didn't want brokers to generate commissions. They want to generate fees, which are more stable. You know, take half a percent of a big number and make the number bigger. You're happy. You don't have that volatility in earnings. So structurally, the VIX has been pushed to these lows from passive investing. The lack of transactional business, you know, being done. You know, that's just, you know, put it in, put X percent here, X percent there, look at it every 3 months. You know, that's where the business has gone. And, for better or for worse. And it's not unlike other times when, you know, business has gone in a certain direction, everybody embraces it, a la, you know, program, you know, the portfolio insurance in the mid 80s in 87. You know, everybody embraced it, you know, till it became a problem. So, I think it's a problem, and that, you know, everybody's in the same narrow group of stocks. You know, if for some reason that, you know, they want to exit it, they're going to be exiting it all at the same time.
Yeah, that's another thing that struck me, too. When you have this high concentration, not only in index funds, but you have four or five financial institutions that really control the vast majority of wealth in this country. I don't care if it's a Vanguard, Fidelity, a BlackRock, a Schwab. If they're all running the index funds and one day John Q. Public decides to get out of the market and get out of his index fund, who are these five guys going to sell to?
The best bid that's out there, and it's not going to be nearby. No, it's going to, you know, the algos learn to pull their bids, and that becomes a problem. Yeah, it's out there. How it, what precipitates it, who knows?
Now, what about the issue of an aging bull market? Usually in the latter stages of a business cycle, which I think we're in now, you start seeing some of the more defensive sectors do well. Healthcare, utilities, consumer staples. Utilities have been doing well, but I'm not so sure if that has more to do with yield chasing or what is driving it, or maybe it's just technology. All these financial gadgets that we use today require power, but the staples have not been doing as well, and healthcare is just starting to break out now. So would you expect to see the more conservative sectors of the S&P start to outperform if we were getting closer to that end date?
They should, if it, but it won't be from the passive people that are just putting it in an index. It's going to have to still be from the thinking part of Wall Street that still says, gee, I don't like the valuations or whatever, you know, and they're going to rotate out of tech and into eat them, drink them, smoke them, you know, the sin stocks that, that do well in a downturn or hold their own in a downturn. So, yeah, that should happen. There have been some occasions like 2008 where nothing worked. I mean, normally when, you know, a slowdown is coming and you can perceive that, you decide to change, make alterations in the portfolio, you know, you move out of lesser grade bonds, you move into the best quality bonds because they're going to be able to continue to pay the coupon as the economy softens. And you move, you know, into, as you mentioned, into more defensive things. You stay invested, you get your dividend, and, you know, it might hold its own or even do okay in a bear. Didn't happen in 2008. Everything was extended and everything went down. You know, nothing worked.
So as we look at the market today, we just talked about this massive amount of money that's going into passive investing. It's non-thinking money. It just happens automatic. You have that aspect of the market, and then you have the algo traders. How much of these two forces are really distorting traditional kind of, I guess, maybe not only on the fundamental side, but also on the technical side? How much of this is being distorted by these two factors?
Well, if you have to look at the net effect, I mean, like volume is, I won't say evaporating, but it's really quiet down there on the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, there's not much going on percentage-wise. You know, it's being done away from the floor, and the floor is at, you know, is like a, you know, a set for CNBC. So, but you can still see movement. Let's say you're looking at an individual stock or an index, and technicians, chartists like to see volume increase with the trend, and the volume is drying up, okay, but because there's not the same amount of transactional business. But you would still see, and at least I've been finding it, you would still see the on-balance volume line from Joe Granville from back in the 60s. That would still work, and I find it does work. So, you know, the market is, you know, a lot of short-term algorithmic trading, and everybody wants to get their master's of financial engineering. They don't want to get a traditional MBA anymore. Those jobs are gone. And, you know, passive, because, you know, they hear the same story over again and over again that you're not going to beat the market. You know, you want to just match it. You know, you want low transaction costs. So public has heard it, or their financial advisor is, you know, steering them that way, whatever it is. But, you know, when I think it was George Patton said something like, when everybody's thinking the same way, nobody's thinking. You know, we've probably come to that. Sentiment is also something that's changed with the change in the marketplace. So with fewer investors being really investors, with them being passive, and, you know, money comes out of their payroll, you know, every 2 weeks, and it goes into their 401k, and it goes in, you know, out the door to Vanguard or wherever. The few transactional people have still reacted like they always do. I wrote a piece for Real Money, I don't know, a week or two ago, about Lam Research, LRCX. And I saw that the volume was drying up into the rally, and the momentum was making a lower high. So it was going up, but at a slower pace. So these are traditional things I've found over the years that, you know, get your antenna up. It can still go higher, but you don't trust the rally if the volume is evaporating and the rate of the of acceleration is slowing. And I got a couple emails that came in like the next day, chewing me out like, you know, I shouldn't be looking at volume. I'm going to miss the next 50 points. They were probably long, you know, out-of-the-money calls, whatever. You put out a bearish story and you get your instant reaction. You know, you can't be possibly right. So we're like at that stage in the market when they're all in and you come along and say something bearish, you know, they don't want to listen to it. You know, they've stopped listening to a different story than what they finally bought into. And sentiment-wise, you know, we don't see it on the cover of Time magazine. We probably see it as, you know, a tweet from our president. He's tweeted about the stock market. So I guess he and Twitter have replaced Time magazine covers. It's just a strange world we live in.
You know, the market forces, every bull market and every bear market's a little bit different. As you mentioned, in 2008, just about nothing worked in that kind of market because everything was so highly correlated. It went down together. What would you be doing right now, Bruce, given what you see in the market and the fact that we're seeing the narrowness of the advance, we're seeing lower volume numbers, the VIX is muted, and we have nothing but headlines every single day? It's almost like a repeated broken record here on the program every Friday. We talk about, well, guess what? The market hit another record this week.
Yeah, so people have come to expect it. You know, I'm trying to think. We don't have the cocktail conversation anymore, but I do get questions from people that know what I do for a living at my synagogue recently. And, you know, the interest is back, you know, from the people that are still interested in the market. And what do you do? Well, there's two ways to sell. I think you should be a scale-up profit taker. It's always tough to sell or recommend selling if you're in an advisory capacity and then still see it go higher. Okay, but in reality, two ways to sell is you sell in advance of a peak because that's where you can get rid of a big position. Let's say you were someone from Omaha or someone from New York, you know, Carl Icahn, you know, people that can have a big position. For instance, Buffett's traders or whoever he has execute his business were selling into strength at 180 on IBM, and they could get it done. And, you know, and a month or two later, he says, oh, yeah, you know, he had a report that, you know, position was reduced. So you sell into strength before the high, and you don't kick yourself if you're, you know, been around the block, that you're not getting the top tick. You're selling on that left shoulder of a distribution pattern where you do have good volume. The public is in, and you can, you know, sell to them. If you wait for the actual peak, you know, we'll say you're not going to get the peak. Only fools and liars sell the, you know, the bottom and the top. But so if you don't get the peak, you have a different problem on the other side. The market comes off, and then you're wishing and hoping to catch some bounce back to the previous high, you know, to be a seller. And that's where you get caught because it doesn't get back up to the previous high. It makes a lower high, it rolls down, and you're still hoping. And you're much more obvious if you try to get rid of a big position after the peak. You know, it's going to work against you because other people are going to be there looking to sell. So you really want to sell in advance of the peak and say, it turns out you leave something on the table. You left it on the table. You know, you don't catch the bottom. You don't catch the top. You're happy with the middle 70% or 80%, whatever, you know. You're happy with that. You shouldn't be a top picker. So you really want to sell in advance of the high. You can move into more defensive areas. We've had a good decline in energy names. I wouldn't say I want to buy all of them, you know, but maybe refiners or something like that. I haven't looked at things away from utilities, so I can't remember what the chart picture looks on like on tobaccos. But there are a number of good-looking pharmaceutical names. I like the base and the breakout and the rally so far and a name like Bristol Myers. So we can rotate into things that have had corrections or have made new bases, and they're just starting to come out of the base. We want to get rid of the things that are, you know, extended, and the rate of momentum has started to slow, and the volume has dried up. So I'm more of the get out of town early when people don't notice that you're selling at the strength than dealing with that psychological problem after the peak, you know, wishing and hoping it goes back up to that previous high to get out, and it doesn't happen.
No, they never ring the bell at the top or ring the bell at the bottom. Great advice, Bruce.
I'll disagree with you. At the bottom, see, at the top, the news and the tape action don't fit. The news is wonderful, and the tape starts to deteriorate. At the bottom, the news and the tape action fit together. News is terrible at the bottom. You know, Chapter 11, Chapter 7, you know, suicides, whatever it is, at a true, you know, capitulation bottom, the news and the tape are in sync. Everybody is fearful at the bottom, but, you know, greed displays itself differently at a top.
Great advice, Bruce. Well, listen, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Well, they can get a free subscription for a while for the various products at thestreet.com. I write for Jim Cramer on Real Money. They have some other different products. And when you get onto the site, you can elect to follow different authors. So they could, you know, decide to follow Bruce Kamek or Jim Cramer or any of the other contributors at the site, and they will get an email alert when I publish something. That's the easiest way. But I think people should read as much as possible and weigh things for themselves. And there are times when I'm going to be wrong, times going to be right, you know. So I think reading a lot, getting different views is a good approach.
And I also might want to point out that you are also author of a book, How Technical Analysis Works, published by the New York Institute of Finance. Well, listen, Bruce, I want to thank you for joining us here on the program. Great to have you on the program for the first time. You've been highly recommended, and I want to thank you for joining us and have yourself a great weekend.
You too. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Carolyn Rosenblatt from AgingParents.com. She's also the author of The Family Guide to Aging Parents. Carolyn, I want to talk about elder abuse. And one of the things that I have seen in my practice, and we've been in this business for almost four decades now, this was something I did not see until I would say probably the last 10, 15 years. Have you found that to be the case? And if so, what is behind this trend? Because it seems to be accelerating. We're finding more and more cases of it within our practice every year.
Well, let me give you my perspective as a nurse and as an attorney. Very interested in this subject because I think a lot can be done to prevent it. First of all, it's nothing new. This has been going on for centuries. We had laws on the books, old English law, that talked about taking advantage of other people. We have a problem with longevity in that it puts people more at risk. I think one of the reasons that you're seeing more of it is that there are 73 million baby boomers who are getting older, who are retirement age, who are accessing rather than putting into their nest eggs. And some of their relatives, caregivers, friends, or professionals in their lives see this as an opportunity to steal. And we have another difficulty here, which is that it's very easy to steal money from someone who knows you and trusts you. We call that undue influence in California, but it's really taking advantage of the relationship. And I think because people are older, a little more vulnerable, perhaps their decision-making capacity is not what it once was. Maybe they have beginnings of dementia. Opportunists in their lives take advantage of that, and that's why you're seeing it more. There are just more people at risk.
Well, the price of oil recently got up to $52 a barrel where it topped out. Now it's been heading lower. Some think it could head lower, while others, very few, think it's going higher. Joining us on the program is Marshall Atkins. He's Director of Energy Research at Raymond James. And Marshall, I want to get to something that you wrote back earlier, and you called it the 10 myths of the oil market. And you attribute a lot of what happened to oil recently with the downturns that we saw due to fake news. Let's get into that and talk about why that amplified oil prices on the downside until recently. Let's talk about a thing that drives a lot of the oil markets in the news, which you talk about in your myth, is a lot of these inventory numbers that we get on weekly inventories and also on production numbers. I wonder, Marshall, if you might address something that I learned a long time ago, that these aren't precise numbers. They're based on models and projections.
Yeah, so what's interesting about the oil market over the last 9 months, in my mind, is you've had this downturn in oil, it creates a negative feedback loop. What I mean by that is industry pundits try to explain why oil prices are going down, even though it may be a sentiment-driven or momentum-driven downturn. They have to come up with reasons for that downturn, and they try to find fundamental reasons. So that's created a lot of this, what I call fake news or negative hyperbole that analysts are scrambling to come up with to explain the downturn. Certainly one of the key things that has fit into that negative hyperbole is numbers from various agencies that are just inaccurate. And, you know, not to pick on them, but a lot of these things are just very hard to measure. A great example is if you look at the IEA data, that's the global keeper of oil data that everyone tends to base their models off of. Historically, they have revised their demand numbers over the last 10 years up about 500,000 barrels a day every year after they initially are reported. And that's been going on for over a decade now. And so if you're starting out the model with demand numbers that are way understated, then you're going to end up looking for a market that's oversupplied, even though inventory data, which it tends to be more accurate, is telling you it's actually an undersupplied market. There's numerous other examples. For example, in gasoline demand this year, the EIA, that's the U.S. agency that measures oil, has suggested that year-to-date gasoline demand in the U.S. is negative. But miles driven year-to-date are up 1.6%. Well, the only way that could happen is if there's been a massive surge in automobile efficiency on the scale that we've never seen before. And that's just not happening. You just have some bad data out there, and we identify that particular area of bad data in gasoline as a mismeasurement of gasoline consumption on the Gulf Coast associated with how they measure refinery output and exports. So that's another good example of they're reporting negative gasoline demand when, in fact, it appears to be very robust in the U.S., along with distillate demand in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. And all that's showing up in inventories. Inventories have fallen at the fastest pace we've seen since I can recall over the past 7 months. So if inventories are falling, it's a very clear sign that the market is undersupplied. So far, the market, from a pricing perspective, seems to be ignoring what I think are very strong fundamentals.
You know, some of the things that I understand that drives the oil market, you have demand, as you mentioned, with the IEA always having to revise upward its actual demand numbers. It's kind of like some of the government reports, Marshall, that we get on GDP. We get one number the first time, and then the second revision, then the third revision. And then the other thing that drives the oil markets, obviously, is on the supply side, but also something that is often forgotten about. And I wonder if you might address this looking further down the road, which is depletion, because we've seen a huge reduction in CapEx spending, unlike we've seen in a long, long time. And sooner or later, the oil that's being produced today by Exxon, Chevron, or whoever is going to have to be replaced. And when you cut back dramatically on CapEx spending, what does this foretell about the future?
Certainly, when you cut international and offshore spending by 50%, that's going to have an impact. Now, the problem with a lot of analysis is, in the case of offshore and international, they're very long lead time projects. And so the spending we're not doing today actually won't show up in the numbers until 2020 or 2019. When it does, we think not only are U.S. producers going to have to satisfy growing global demand, but declines outside the U.S. and declines from offshore. It's hard to gauge exactly what those will be in 2020, 21, 22, but probably, you know, 500,000 barrel a day decline in production is reasonable. So if demand is growing 1 million and supply outside the U.S. has fallen 500,000, well, U.S. producers are going to have to come up with 1.5 million a day every year for the next 5 to 10 years. And so certainly if you're not spending the money, the depletion is going to hit you. The other, I think, unappreciated part of depletion is unless the rig count marches higher in the future, fed by higher cash flows and higher oil prices, then the U.S. can't grow 1.5 million a day at the current rig count. Why? Because the more these shale wells we drill, yeah, they're big producers, but they're big producers in year one and two. And so the bigger the universe of shale wells, then the higher the average decline rates. And our math shows that by 2020, 2021, it's going to be very difficult for the U.S. to grow production 1.5 million a day unless you see meaningfully higher oil prices and more activity than we have today.
This brings up a point, because when we go back to the year 2014, when we had oil prices at 110, shale was really taken off. There were a lot of rigs out there drilling shale oil. And then, of course, the prices dropped. They fell way lower than many people thought. Let's talk about the implications of what that means right now and going forward, because even though the rig count has doubled, I don't think it's anywhere near where it was in 2014. So what about those shale wells that were drilled in 2014 that max out their production in the first 2 years and are now into dramatic declines? What does this tell us about production going forward?
Yeah, it's really interesting. As we ramped up the learning curve on these horizontal wells, what we now call the shale wells, and by the way, a little side note, they're not all actually shale rock. They're in a bunch of different tight rock, but Everyone understands it'll be shale oil, so we'll call them that. The interesting thing about that is from 2011 through 2015 or 16, the average productivity per well grew about 35% per year. I challenge you to find another industry in the U.S. that's seen its productivity grow 35% a year for 5 years, particularly one that's 150 years old. I mean, it's just the feat that the U.S. industry has accomplished is absolutely staggering. The problem with those efficiency gains, though, is there is a law of diminishing returns, and we're starting to bump up against those productivity gain improvements. We just can't simply keep putting up 35% a year. We saw the productivity growth slow in 16. It's clearly slowing again in 17. And, you know, that's going to be the real challenge for U.S. producers, is overcoming the slowing of well productivity growth. We're reaching maximum limits, practical limits, if you will, on horizontal wellbore length. We're reaching optimal and maximum levels of sand and frac cluster combination in these wells. So I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for the industry going forward. It didn't show up too much in 15, you know, post the 14 meltdown, because we were continuing to post those gains in productivity. I think the bigger problem is going to show up in 18, 19, and 20 as we reach the maximum limits of these productivity gains. So, you know, we'll see. There's a lot of argument out there right now. Just what are the productivity changes going to be going forward? In fact, Harold Hamm, the other day, the CEO of Continental, suggested that the back half of this year, productivity gains will be zero to negative in the U.S. as we do more infill drilling of these horizontal wells. And I'll tell you, if he's right in that conclusion, that's a very bullish indicator for crude prices.
You still believe that we're going to hit $60 to $65 a barrel. OPEC is talking about extending its cuts beyond the first quarter of next year, and they're doing something that they're emphasizing with fellow members. They're cutting back on their exports, especially to the U.S. What is the likelihood that this happens? In other words, what is it going to take to drive that price higher? We got up to recently 52, where we seem to be topping out on the charts. And there are a lot of people that follow the market that look at these charts, and they're saying, hey, at 52, it tends to pull back, which it did. But what will be the driver that gets it up to 60? Is it the realization that the drawdowns in inventory are much greater and the production isn't as great as we thought? Is it going to be something like that where we wake up to what you call some of these fake news stories or these reports that we rely on that have to be revised? What will it be?
It's interesting. With the massive inventory drawdowns we've seen this year, I would have thought the market already would have responded to these inventory reductions in a more favorable way or more bullish way than it already has. So we've reviewed some of the things that have, you know, maybe convinced the market that oil should not be higher. At the end of the day, though, the fundamentals always win. And I think the catalyst is going to be a combination of things, but it starts with the physical market and the players. They're actually buying and selling the crude and filling these storage tanks going, uh-oh, we've got a problem. We don't have enough crude. And they start to bid up the physical market. That's already happening in Europe. You see Brent prices $5 or $6 higher than the U.S., which suggests the global market is already very tight, and the physical players in that market are already taking oil up higher. And so I think that's the first thing that happens, is the physical market takes over. Based on our estimates, we are now below normal on a global basis of days of consumption of inventories on the worldwide stage. And in the U.S., we also think we're below normal, and we measure that more on a days of production, since we use our inventories to facilitate oil movement around the U.S. So I think inventories, as of the third quarter, fell below normal. As they continue to fall over the next 3 to 6 months, we expect the guys that are actually running the physical markets to react and bid oil higher. It already is doing that for Brent. WTI will follow. And yes, we think prices average $65 next year, which obviously is meaningfully higher than the 50-ish dollar range we're looking at today on the screen.
One of the things that I don't know why it is in the oil markets, we tend to go to extremes either on the high side as we did in the summer of 2008 or on the low side as we did last year when we got down to $26. I want to move to the companies that actually produce this stuff. Over the years, we've seen the cost of producing shale come down dramatically, and a lot of companies can make money in this lower oil environment that we've been operating in the last couple of years. If you look at the S&P profits for the first quarter and the second quarter, a good part of the increase was driven by energy companies, and yet that hasn't been fully reflected in the stocks. What do you think that is the case?
Well, a couple points to be made there. Yes, shale oil here in the U.S. has become the cheapest oil source in the world. Now, that said, a lot of people out there saying, well, God, the Permian Basin guys can make money at $35 a barrel. Well, yeah, on the next well drilled, but not on a full cycle. Not if you include all the costs. The break-evens just aren't that low. So that's point number one. And in fact, you know, we think that if you fully load everything, the break-evens are more 50-55 for the industry, using just the Permian, which is the best area. If it were so profitable, oil is going to average high 40s this year, and we only have a handful of companies that are cash flow positive. Well, I would say about 5% of our universe is cash flow positive with oil in the high 40s. So that tells you a lot. That said, there's been a substantial improvement across the board in profitability, and you're exactly right, particularly for the big guys that drive the S&P earnings. The industry has reduced cost to the point to where off of a very low base, the earnings increase has been meaningful. And at the same time, the weighting of energy in the S&P has gone down. So as an analyst looking at energy, I relish opportunities like this where you have very negative sentiment for oil, a lot of apathy for energy stocks. They just, you know, who cares about energy? It's such a low weighting of any index, so we don't really care. Combined with what we've already talked about earlier, the very strong fundamentals that are clearly showing up in inventories falling, both in the U.S. and around the world. The combination of those two things is a perfect storm, if you will. Negative sentiment combined with positive fundamentals, those are the things you look for as an investor opportunistically to make money. So, yeah, to me, it doesn't make sense that you are seeing a recovery in the industry, recovering in earnings for the bigger guys, combined with deterioration in these stocks relative to the overall market. I actually think we've turned the corner. Oil seems, as it went back through 50, broke through some resistance lines on the way up. So I think we're in the process of a technical breakout. More importantly, energy has been one of the worst performing groups year to date, except for the last month. Energy was actually the best performing subsector in the market over the last month. So the more that starts to happen, the more investors will begin to pay attention and say, wait a minute, wait, energy is outperforming now. Maybe I need to get some of that in my portfolio.
Well, I'm like you. I've been bullish on energy, looking at some of these fundamental numbers, and I'm also watching tanker traffic and some of these drawdowns and also some of these production numbers, because I've been in this business long enough to know, Marshall, just like we get with these economic numbers, whether it's GDP or the unemployment rate, we always know that they're revised, and I've seen these IEA numbers that are revised upward. So given this, if we were to have this conversation on December 31st, the price of oil now a little over $50 a barrel, would you expect $60 oil by the end of the year?
Yeah, I think it's very possible in the next 3 months we see a $10 move in the price of crude. Now, you know, to be fair, I thought we would have seen it before now. So, you know, the fundamentals, I think, and the inventory drawdowns would have told me, you know, this should have already happened by June or July, and here we are in October, and we're still 50. But yes, based on every trend I see, I think there's a meaningful upside in the next 3 months, and I think that carries through the full year of 2018. And one last point I'd make is that assumes that everything goes well in the Middle East and Venezuela. What are the odds of that for the next year to 18 months?
Very low, in my opinion. So, Marshall, if you were to play this, how would you play this? Would you go into an ETF like XLE, or would you buy a handful of different stocks from large cap to mid cap?
You know, if oil does what we think it is, you know, energy stocks across the board do well. You know, we cover many different segments of the energy segment. Really depends on your risk profile. I think both E&P, U.S. levered E&P, and U.S. completions levered service companies, I think, end up on top. Those should do very well in the environment that I foresee happening for crude. You know, if you want maybe a little safer, lower risk play, then you look at some of the transport companies, specifically the pipeline and infrastructure companies. As much as we think U.S. production will grow, the guys that move that oil around the country are ones that give you a very nice yield and growth on top of that. So I wouldn't rule out the midstream sector. I think that's very attractive. And oddly enough, you know, that sector wins, you know, even if supply is growing more than we think in the U.S., that sector wins with more supply growth. So fundamentally, it's a more defensive sector, even though the stock prices have not proven that out over the last 6 months. But across the board, all energy stocks, even, you know, the Canadian stocks should do well, the oil sand stocks should do well, pretty much across the board, anyone levered to higher crude prices, and even a lot that aren't. I mean, a lot of the gassy E&P names in the U.S. tend to trade with crude for some reason. Those probably do okay. So I would tell you it almost doesn't matter as long as you're getting a group that's been beat up with the oil downturn over the past few years.
Well, fabulous, Marshall. I want to thank you for joining us on the program. If our listeners would like to follow your work like I do, how can they do so, please?
Well, contact your Raymond James broker. I head up the energy research effort here at Raymond James. We have 20 of us here in Houston, another half dozen plus in Calgary and other parts of the world. So you can get our research and concepts and ideas through your local broker.
Marshall, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Great work and great analysis. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It seems like the financial crisis is a distant memory now. Wait, it's 8 years behind. And after huddling in fear on the sideline, the small investor is getting into the market. But wait, we're entering the third stage of the bull market. And also we're in a rate raising cycle. And since financial market people are always looking into the future to try to tell us what's happening, what does that really mean? Are we headed down to another recession? And is there danger ahead? What is the risk factor? All of that subject of conversation coming up today on The Big Picture as Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.